Attention, this is not legal advice. If you are experiencing a legal emergency, contact an attorney or your local public defender's office.
The views expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of Gin and Justice. Talk about justice.
Hey, I'm Justine.
And I'm Amanda.
Welcome to another legal brief with Gin and Justice. This week, we don't have any legal concepts, but we do, of course, want to share some criminal justice news, criminal justice reform news, and maybe some other random things.
We got a bunch of it, so
yes.
Rapid fire.
Yes. So I know you have news about Tennessee.
I do. Governor Lee, who we talk about a lot on the show because he's been doing a lot of stuff in reform. He just signed a bill into law that would modernize the state's intellectual disability law and prevent unconstitutional executions of people with intellectual disabilities, which I thought was already a thing because
some states it's a thing.
Obviously, we shouldn't be killing people with disabilities.
Yeah.
But
and I heard that they think that this may help in the case of Purvis Payne,
mm-hmm.
which is in Tennessee. So speaking of death penalty. I know we talked about the death penalty in our last legal brief and with the Juan Melendez episode, but I actually learned some things that I thought were really important to know. So, as you guys probably know, we are constantly looking for interesting guests to interview on the show from all different perspectives of the criminal justice system, and I was trying to find a doctor who administers the lethal injection drugs and, executes people to interview on the show and see if that was something we could accomplish. But you know what I learned? Is that we can never have one of those on the show because their identities are protected because...
Yeah, they took an oath not to do any harm.
To human beings. So they're not supposed to. It's totally against their ethics. So... they come into the execution chambers in big purple suits so people can't identify them. So I learned that. I also learned that we are running really low on a lot of the lethal injection drugs. So, and I know we talked about firing squads, but...
South Carolina.
Right, South Carolina. And there is a state that still allows hanging. They also have... obviously, the firing squads. And then they have in, I think it was Utah, gas chambers. Right. But there were some difficulties with the gas chambers.
You don't say.
So what they do instead now is they have the person to be executed wear this mask. And then they put this like thing in there and it releases... I know I'm being very descriptive here. Using good words. I want to say it's a pill and it releases nitrous whatever gas. It's like a lethal gas. And they basically strap a person to a table
and
put a gas mask on them and then they inhale this deadly gas. Mm-hmm. So, and there are still issues with that method as well. And then obviously there's still the electric chair, which I think is the preferred method here in Florida. I believe that Ted Bundy was electrocuted here.
Do you remember that time that we met the cop that arrested him?
No. Where were we?
It was when we were working at that bar.
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah, we got him drunk.
That was really interesting. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, I wish we still worked there just so that we can get an interview with that guy.
So, with that said, moving on. The state of Alabama under Governor Ivey has passed a couple of criminal justice reform bills within the last week or so. And let me just tell you that they came as a result of the United States Department of Justice sued the Alabama Department of Corrections, I guess because the prisons were so packed and the conditions were so dangerous to not only inmates but also staff because of the way that their prison systems are packed. So there was a prison crisis, as they have described it, and in 2019, they put together a committee that was going to basically review their laws and the sentencings and all of that and kind of give suggestions on how to alleviate the population in prison and the prison crises that Alabama is and was facing, well, is still facing. And so they did pass a series of laws as a result of the recommendations that came out of that committee.
I'll do the first one.
All right.
Senate Bill 323 directs the Department of Corrections to set up programs allowing inmates to become eligible for parole up to a year earlier if they do educational or vocational training, which is really cool. The law is called the Alabama Education Incentive Act.
Oh, very appropriate. So that's a law that I feel like we're luckily seeing passed at a couple of different states around the country right now. I was looking at the Senate Bill 221, and basically that creates a new position within the Board of Parole or Board of Prisons that is supposed to continuously study and make recommendations to reduce recidivism. So whether that's more job training, more transitional programs, you know, whatever they come up with, but that's going to be somebody's job. So there's a brand new position available in the Department of Corrections that is supposed to come up with ideas, essentially, is what it sounded like to me when I read it.
That's awesome. Then we got House Bill 106, which increases oversight in the Department of Corrections. They'll have to file reports to the Prison Oversight Committee on circumstances of inmate deaths and sexual assaults. The results of the investigations will include information on the sizes of the inmate population, the staffing levels, who's participating in all of the programs that they're introducing.
So stuff that they
should have been doing.
No.
Right. But hey, you know, better now than never. So
that's very true.
This is all progress.
That's very true. And the last one that I have is House Bill 137. And that's similar to a law that just got passed here in Florida. It creates the sexual assault response team. And with that, victims are going to be able to track their sexual assault kits and see when they're disposed of, when they're tested, and kind of be able to track where they're at in the criminal justice system.
Right.
So, and you know how we feel about the backlog of rape kits.
Yes, actually, let's talk about that for a second. For anybody that doesn't know about the problem that we have in this country with the backlog of rape kits, I suggest highly that you...
Not that we haven't talked about it a time or two, but go on.
You need to watch the documentary. It's on HBO. It's Mariska Hargitay. I Am Evidence. It's disturbing.
Who is probably one of Amanda's favorite people.
Yes, I love her. And I still love Law and Order, even though it's not accurate.
Yeah, thank you.
Never watch Law and Order with a lawyer.
Actually, FYI. Yeah, no. I'll just ruin every part of it. I just come into Amanda's living room and tell her, that would never happen. That would never happen. This is so false. This would never happen.
So true.
So, but speaking of labs and backlogs, this is something that I basically kept a secret from you that I wanted to report on in our criminal justice reform legal brief. Essentially, I don't know if you're aware, but back in the early 2010s, there was a crime lab, a state-run crime lab in Massachusetts, and two chemists out of the lab basically were engaging in what I have learned is called dry labbing.
And oh God, what is that?
There is a document. I'm pretty sure the documentary on Netflix is about these particular chemists, but essentially they were making up their own tests. They were forging data. There was many false positives on drug tests. People were taking drugs from the lab. I should say these two chemists have been found to have been taking drugs from the lab, kind of just running their own experiments that had no scientific backing and weren't oversaw by anybody. And this is the state-run crime lab. So, right, okay, again, if you guys could see Amanda's face right now. So that was back in the early 2010s. At that time, first they thought it was one chemist. As they did a little bit of investigation, they realized it was two. So now, actually when that happened, they had the Office of the Inspector General, which for those of you who don't know, the OIG in each state and in the feds is kind of like internal affairs, or they're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And they kind of make sure that everybody's complying with what they're supposed to in any state-run or government-run agencies or facilities.
I am so scared right now.
So the OIG began to investigate the first chemist. they found, nope, she was the only one that was doing this. She was the one bad apple, and there's no reason to look any further into this. So then it comes out, like, maybe a year or so later, that there was a second chemist. Yeah, so they found it was actually two of these women. So at that point, the state attorney or the district attorney of that area ordered, you know, kind of the OIG to go back and review again. Well, they came back, no different results. Now, here we are many years later, and they're looking back and reviewing all of these cases, which, by the way, up until today, has already caused 20,000 overturned and convictions, which has cost upward of $30 million to the taxpayers. So, and the state attorney...
I did not know where you were going with this.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So... they have overturned 20,000 convictions already and counting just for the period of time with these particular chemists. Now the state attorney has just, or the district attorney, has just ordered the review of another 74,000 cases that were involved with this particular lab. So herein lies the problem. What's being kind of represented across the country? So not just with crime labs that analyze drugs, but also... labs that analyze forensics. So there was a crime lab in Texas, which also was severely underfunded. Also, it was a state run. So when something is state run, it's overseen by law enforcement. The crime labs are typically overseen by law enforcement. Hence lies part of the issue.
That should be a problem.
It is. And it's starting to finally show. And there's it's part of this trend.
Who came up with this pecking order?
Right.
Wow.
So there's a couple cases in Texas, and we see this often, and we see often in the jobs that we do where law enforcement is straight up lying. And I'm not saying that every law enforcement officer is a liar.
We know that there's plenty of great cops, guys.
Yes. But we've seen it where it affects somebody's life. They go to jail. They lose their kids. I think it was maybe last year that woman at the Alabama crime lab admitted to... giving back all these false positives in these drug tests, and people lost their kids. Their kids are adopted out to other people. Their parental rights have terminated. You can't just go back on that. So yeah, so there's that.
Makes me so angry.
Yeah. And so the other part of the issue, right, is these same labs are also doing the forensics, which are coming back on all of these. A lot of times you'll see the exonerees came back from false forensics or forensic scientists who were just dry labbing, which I never explain what the term is really, but it's basically where there's no,
sounds dirty.
It's severely underfunded and there's no oversight. So people are just either making up their own data, doing false tests that aren't real tests, or they're doing things, they're just kind of like making up their own experiments and then using it as qualitative data or like, hey, you know what, Amanda, I think I'm going to come up with a new test to how to test cocaine. And then I just kind of like throw like some, I don't know, like baking soda and super glue and like maybe some lemon together. And then like to me, I'm pretty sure that's going to, you know, come up with a cocaine test. And then if something turns this color, then yes, that's, you know, it's, so that's what was happening in this Massachusetts lab.
So every defense attorney in Massachusetts with drug cases is like using this, right? They would have to.
And you know who else is kind of discussing it and filing lawsuits is the ACLU of Massachusetts.
Of course they are. They're the best.
So, so anyways, this Texas lab in particular had a couple very notorious cases. And as a result, they shut that lab down. And now they have, it's called, I want to say it was called the Forensic Center of Houston or Houston Forensic Center. And that is a completely independent forensic lab. It's overseen by prosecutors, defense attorneys, law enforcement, and most importantly, citizens. So, oh, awesome. And their budget is allocated accordingly, according to what the needs are. So that was something really interesting. But I will be interested to see how these over 100,000 cases in Massachusetts end up. I just feel like anything that came out of the lab at that point in time just can't be trusted.
Right.
So, and who knows? Who knows what else is going on there or has gone on there? So, because obviously the OIG really didn't do a real investigation.
To let the police be the ones to make sure everything's going right.
Yeah, so it's
when they're like, the ones that are trying to prove the crime happened.
Right. So state run, government run. It's like our crime lab in Florida is
like the system is rigged. Like it's rigged.
As we're finding out from exonerations and cases like this.
So disturbing.
So that was my secret criminal justice news I wanted to share with you.
Wow.
Yes. But in better news.
Well, Washington just signed in 12 laws to overhaul policing. They were signed last Tuesday, I believe. The bill bans chokeholds.
Tuesday's the day for justice, just saying.
It bans chokeholds, neck restraints, the use of tear gas by police, and it prohibits police agencies from collecting military-style equipment.
Oh, that's good. That's been going on since, like, the war on drugs. Any leftover military budget and equipment just goes straight to the police departments.
Yeah, that's wild.
You know, equipment meant for war.
Yeah, that's so crazy to me. It also bans the use of no-knock warrants, which we all know that we need everywhere.
Right. Yeah.
It also establishes an independent investigations department with the governor's office to investigate deadly force incidents that occur after July 1st, 2022, which is a little concerning that they're not starting that now or had been doing that, but it's still progress. So it also, it creates a reasonable care standard that requires officers to use de-escalation tactics, which again, feel like should be a thing already, but here we are.
Mm-hmm.
In 2021.
Mm-hmm. So. It is nice to see because you'll kind of see like smaller areas as well. Like I know somewhere around here they implemented this experimental program where when they're responding to like a crisis, they bring a social worker with them or an addiction counselor
so
with them.
Important.
Right, right. And so here's the
like
thing is,
it shouldn't be on police to deal with mental health situations.
No, it shouldn't be because like, you're trained to make the community safer.
And honestly, they don't make enough money to be doing mental health calls.
Nor is there the proper training in place. You can only be trained with like one specialty, I feel like. And if it's arresting people in a proper way to make the community safer and do your investigations without violating people's rights, then that's the training we should focus on.
I would agree. Okay, so under this bill, the Criminal Justice Training Commission, they're expanding their effectiveness and professionalism within the police. It establishes a better rapport between the police and the community.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of communities are trying to do that, so.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
All right. Do you have anything else?
Nah.
I don't think so either. Well, anyways, we're glad you tuned in for this random legal brief, and we will see you next time on Gin and Justice.
Bye.
All editing for Gin and Justice done by Gin and Justice Podcast.
Artwork by Justin Cardone. Photography by Kimber Schwakey.
We'll see you next time on Gin and Justice.